This program is sponsored in part by the American Brain Foundation. For over 30 years, the foundation has worked with researchers to discover better treatments, prevention, and cures for brain diseases and disorders. Imagine life without brain disease. Learn more at AmericanBrainFoundation.org. Epilepsy Foundation Florida leads the fight to overcome the challenges of living with epilepsy and to accelerate therapies to stop seizures, find cures, and save lives. Visit epilepsy.com/Florida to find out how to get involved today. Neurelis, a leading neuroscience company focused on the development and commercialization of therapeutics for the treatment of epilepsy and other neurologic disorders. The company's unique drug portfolios strive to address unmet needs in patient care. Learn more at Neurelis.com.
Hi, I'm Dr. Joe Servin, a neurologist that practices at the Mayo Clinic here in Jacksonville. This is What's Health Got to Do With It, which looks at where and how healthcare intersects with your life, helping you get the medical answers you want. And just ahead, we'll take a look at some of the biggest healthcare headlines with our monthly medical roundtable. Then later, we talk to one group of doctors that is advocating to help lower over-the-top prescription drug prices. But first, we're excited to welcome you to our monthly medical roundtable, where we discuss the latest healthcare developments. On this Halloween weekend, we're pleased to welcome some scary smart guests. Dr. Jennifer Cowart, a hospice physician in Jacksonville and part of the group Doctors Fighting COVID. Dr. Swapna Reddy, professor of health policy, equity, and diversity at Arizona State University. And Dr. Chirag Patel, UF Health JAX's assistant chief medical officer. Thank you all for joining us. And let's begin with COVID-19 updates. Finally, some good news. COVID cases are falling nationally. Here in Florida, hospitalizations, COVID-19 deaths, and new infections continue to decrease. We are awash with vaccines, and booster shots are now top of mind, as are shots for children under 11, which should begin in November. The U.S. FDA has authorized booster injections of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine 6 months after the second dose for those at high risk, such as the immunocompromised, and workers with increased exposure to the virus. The FDA has also authorized booster shots for those individuals 65 years and older and the immunocompromised who received the Moderna vaccine. Additionally, they approved a booster for all individuals aged 18 years and up who received the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. Now we can even mix and match COVID-19 booster shots. In medical terms, this is called a heterologous prime boost, meaning if your first dose with Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine, you can receive a booster with either the Moderna or Johnson & Johnson vaccine. This combination approach is based on a federally funded mix-and-match study presented to an expert committee that advises the Food and Drug Administration. The study found that recipients of Johnson & Johnson's single-dose shot who received a Moderna booster saw their antibody levels rise 76-fold in 15 days, compared with only a 4-fold increase after an extra dose of Johnson & Johnson vaccine. There's also good news on the vaccine front for kids. Pfizer reported that its vaccine was 90.7% effective in preventing symptomatic COVID-19 in children ages 5 to 11, according to clinical trial data. Similarly, Moderna released results from a preliminary analysis of their pediatric study that showed a robust neutralizing antibody response after 2 doses of vaccine. Meanwhile, Merck has asked the FDA for emergency use authorization of its antiviral pill, molnupiravir. The pill is meant to be taken after you've experienced COVID-19 symptoms. In the clinical trial, molnupiravir was given to study participants in 4 capsules twice a day for 5 days, starting within 5 days of patients experiencing the first symptoms of COVID-19. It's not a cure-all, but is designed to keep people out of the hospital. So to open it up, Dr. Cowart, recently Colin Powell passed away, very sad, fully vaccinated from COVID-19, but immunocompromised from multiple myeloma he was battling. Does this mean the vaccine doesn't work?
Well, What a good question. And first off, you know, my thoughts are with Colin Powell's family in his loss. You know, the vaccines, all vaccines work best in people who have the immune system ability to build the antibodies given to them by the vaccine. And multiple myeloma is a blood disorder that can impair the body's ability directly to make healthy antibodies. Also, the treatments that we give to people with multiple myeloma impair their immune system either through chemotherapy or steroid doses. So patients with multiple myeloma, like Colin Powell and like my grandmother who had multiple myeloma, are immunocompromised in a variety of ways. So it's hard to predict for me, not having taken care of Mr. Powell, whether he, you know, formed proper antibodies after his vaccine or if he was unable to because of the multiple myeloma and his treatment,
right,
or even with antibodies, if his body, you know, had other issues related to myeloma, such as kidney failure, et cetera. So no, I would not say that this means the vaccine doesn't work. Vaccines are not 100%. They do reduce the chance of serious health outcomes like this. I'm very sorry that that he passed away anyway. And when we've studied patients who have passed away after COVID, in those few cases where patients have had the vaccine and passed away anyway from COVID, it's unfortunate patients just like Colin Powell. So they're older, they have more health problems. They may or may not have formed a great immune response to the vaccine because of those health problems, and they may have had other risk factors that rendered them more at risk to the virus. But I would like to emphasize that when we've studied this, we're looking at such a small population of patients who have vaccine breakthrough infections that need to be in the hospital compared to the broader population of COVID patients that need to come to the hospital, the vast majority of whom are unvaccinated. So we see risk reductions related to the vaccine, which is great. But risk reduction doesn't mean zero harm or zero risk of getting COVID after the vaccine, if that makes sense. And that's how I think of this new drug, the molnupiravir. It greatly reduces the risk of hospitalization or death with a COVID infection. But of course, that's not zero. And it must be given early in the course of infection. So these conversations are difficult and somewhat nuanced. And, you know, as we all just continue to grapple with this serious infection and looking at the science and how it changes.
No, I appreciate that. And so at the end, it's another reminder, the immunocompromised is one of those groups we have to always be mindful of, and that the answers of masking and distancing still mean something, even with all this treatments and vaccines available.
Absolutely.
Dr. Reddy, my patient in the clinic asked me the other day, it was kind of a philosophical question, but I think it's a fair one. Dr. Servin, is the pandemic over? Are people still getting sick and dying? What's your response to that?
it's an excellent question, and I think we're hearing that across the board. You mentioned you heard it from a patient. I hear it from students. I hear it from my own kids, right? Absolutely, the pandemic is still happening. We're certainly seeing a reduction in numbers, which, as you mentioned at the top of this discussion, is a great thing across the country. But I think what is really important here is the fact that people are asking that question because there is a perception, certainly in our society, that the pandemic is over, right? And where are people getting this perception? Well, if you look around, there's great variances, right, in masking. There's great variances in policies around required masking, around required vaccinations, and then just public behavior. I mean, we have full stadiums. We have all kinds of parties going on. We have the holiday season coming up. So there's certainly large segments of our society that are behaving like the pandemic is over and are not really, you know, taking any sort of mitigation steps. And we certainly still have a significant gap in those that are vaccinated in this country. And then there are folks that, you know, are still behaving like the pandemic still is continuing, right? And so we are masking indoors and you know, we are vaccinated and promoting vaccination amongst our communities, et cetera. So it doesn't surprise me that question is being asked, but I think the fact that the question is being asked is really a reflection of this kind of like two different realities that are happening in this country right now, when the facts are that, yes, we are still living through a pandemic.
Yeah, I get also the sense that a lot of people are just fatigued by this whole thing.
Yeah, they're over it, right? I mean, a lot of folks are over it. And look, I think we can relate to that. I mean, who's not over it right now? We all want this thing to be over. And we're all fatigued by it. And gosh knows, especially those in the healthcare industry, but, you know, also parents. I mean, I'm a parent myself, and it's exhausting right now. That being said, I think, you know, the danger that's happening is that that fatigue is really influencing our behaviors, and it's influencing our reactions to mitigation strategies and mitigation policies. And that's where the danger lies, because we are not clear of this thing yet. And I think that that's the really important message, but we can be, but we just kind of have to, you know, I think we have to be realistic about the two realities that we're living in right now.
Dr. Patel, what are you telling your patients about mix and match boosters at this time?
Here is we've got data now that is telling us it's okay to do. I think it's going to be a personal choice of whether you want to stick with the same product that you've gotten, or if you're you have a conversation with your healthcare provider and they recommend and you agree that you should go with a mixed dose. My personal opinion is simply that the data is showing that there is benefit by mixing the dose. And as such, you know, that's what I would recommend to my patients if they asked me. But again, I think it's a very personal choice. I think that if you stick with the same product, you're still going to get exceptional protection, some of the best vaccine protection we've seen in our history when it comes to vaccinations. And so at the end of the day, bottom line is if you're eligible or and or due for a booster, go get it to maximize your protection.
So it's at the end, just get any booster. If you can stick to the same one, sure, but otherwise any booster will do.
Absolutely.
Dr. Cowart, a listener question from social media. Jennifer from Orange Park asks, what about my six-year-old? Can I just get him vaccinated since everyone else seems to be doing this?
Oh, I can't wait for my five-year-old and nearly nine-year-old to be vaccinated. The dose will be different in children. We're expecting the Pfizer dose to be lower. And I think when Moderna is seeking approval, their dose will be lower as well. So we don't want to give our kids the wrong dose of this vaccine. We want to be sure that they don't get the adult dose, since we know that they'll be getting a different dose for the young kids. So we are so close. At this point, I think the committee is meeting this week, and the expectation is as soon as the beginning of November that we should be able to get shots in arms for our kids. That, you know, what I'm trying to do is sit on my hands and just be patient. And I've already asked my pediatrician, how can I access this vaccine for my children once it's available? It looks like it might not be available at my personal pediatrician. So I'm looking at the local pharmacies and other routes to be able to get those vaccines for my kids. The other thing in preparation is I've talked to my kids, both of them. They, you know, they're kids, they hate shots. And I've already talked to them about why it's so important that they get their shots for COVID, so that we can travel maybe for Christmas and go see grandmothers and do things that are a little more normal. So I'm just trying to be patient. I know we have, you know, hopefully maybe just one or two more weeks to wait for the kids that are 5 to 11. And of course, the vaccine's still in studies for the under 5 crew. But I'm in that same boat. I can't wait for my kids to be protected. I continue to be very, very careful personally and wear my mask and try to limit those indoor gatherings where possible, because I am protected and in fact boosted, but my children are too young to be vaccinated. And so I'm always concerned, could I, you know, bring home a mild case, but give it to my kids and get them sick. So I share your concern, and we will have a vaccine social distance Zoom party, perhaps, once we're able to get the vaccines in the arms of our kids, hopefully within the next couple of weeks.
Well, we'll wait patiently until that time. Dr. Reddy, we talked a little in the introduction about the new Merck pill. Do you see this as a game changer? Will this change everything in terms of our approach having that?
Well, you know, from what we know about this pill, yeah, it could be a game changer, because let's think about some of the games that need changing. In terms of treatment, and especially, you know, as Dr. Cowart mentioned, that this is really an early treatment strategy. We've had issues with access to treatment, right? Especially for populations that have sort of limitations with access to care historically and currently. So this could really be a game changer in terms of access if we make it accessible, easily accessible and affordable, or free. It can really reduce the burden on the hospital and healthcare system, because as you mentioned, you know, this is a pill, and this is certainly far less invasive than the existing treatments that are here. And I mean, if we can reduce the burden on the healthcare system right now, a year and a half into this pandemic, I think that's nothing but good, right? From a cost perspective, from a burnout perspective, from a capacity perspective, from the perspective of getting folks back in and receiving the healthcare that maybe they've been putting off during the pandemic, or that they haven't been able to access because of full hospitals. We certainly still have hot spots around the country where there's just a restriction on procedures and surgeries that are not COVID related because they're so full. The beds are so full with COVID patients. Idaho is a great example of that. So this can certainly reduce the burden on hospital and healthcare systems. And I want to think also, you know, from an equity perspective and a global perspective, could be a game changer globally, right? I mean, right. We're certainly seeing the impact of this pandemic still surging, especially in the developing world. So if this could be easily accessible, and that's an if, and it could be a big if, but hopefully it's not, it could be a game changer in the global fight against COVID as well.
You're listening.
Can I offer
on that? Go ahead,
yeah,
Dr. Patel.
You know, I will say a couple things. So first of all, you know, I think that this is an extremely promising medication, molnupiravir. I practiced a few times saying it, so molnupiravir. But I, like you, it was a tongue twister for sure. You know, it definitely could be something that is going to be a game changer. I want to just tamp expectations just based on the data alone. You know, you're looking at the data studied in unvaccinated patients with mild to moderate COVID illness that were in the first 5 days of symptoms. You know, we're going to have many of those who are going to progress to severe illness that are going to require hospitalization. But those who are already too far gone are not necessarily going to benefit from this medication. So at the end of the day, keep in mind that the best way to stay out of the hospital and to avoid passing away from COVID is not getting it in the first place. And our silver bullet remedy for that at this point is vaccination. Now, all that being said, yes, it is a pill versus an injection. And for those who are needle averse, this could be really beneficial. But this is something that needs to be taken twice a day for 5 days, as opposed to one monoclonal antibody injection or even a vaccine. So I don't want us to get too far ahead of ourselves thinking that this is going to be something that's going to be a silver bullet. Every single one of us in healthcare and the general public is desperate for more options to help our patients overcome this illness. And I really hope that the molnupiravir data is as good as it seems, and it's ultimately going to get authorized, and it's going to help as many people out there globally as possible. But I think we need to remain patient and stick with the strategies that we know work at this time, which are washing our hands, wearing our mask, socially distancing, and if you haven't already gotten your vaccine or your booster, going out and getting it.
You're listening to
Dr. Patel more, and I want to add that you still have to get diagnosed with COVID in order to qualify to take molnupiravir. And so, you know, in this last Delta surge that we experienced here in Duval County, testing remained a pretty hot commodity. It was difficult to access for many people. Long lines at the city testing sites. You know, the home kits were sold out across the city for weeks. So I 100% agree. It's better never to get COVID, and by getting the vaccine and wearing a mask. And then if you do get COVID, it's still extremely important to go get tested early and be diagnosed early, because you may qualify currently for the monoclonal antibody injection or infusion. And then when this new drug is available, you might qualify for the drug, but you have to have a diagnosis first.
Great.
Yeah, and I third all of those recommendations.
I love it. So let me break in here to remind our audience that you're listening to What's Health Got to Do with It on WJCT News 89.9. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, and today we're discussing the biggest healthcare headlines with our monthly medical roundtable. And we want to hear from you. If you have a question for our panel or for our next episode, which will be devoted to healthcare for veterans, tweet me at Jay Servin. Email us at health@wjct.org or leave us a message at 904-358-6362. Before we transition into our next segment, we want to warn listeners that we are discussing subjects that might be distressing to some listeners, including suicide. Please call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255 or dial 988 if you need help. And if you or someone you know is in immediate danger, dial 911 or go to your nearest emergency department. Suicide is preventable and help is available. My wife and I were walking our dogs in our neighborhood and ran into a neighbor who asked me about declining COVID numbers at the hospital where I work. He said, "Finally, we can get back to normal." I walked away and it struck me that I have no idea what normal means anymore. Media outlets worldwide still report the devastating impacts of the COVID pandemic. We know that in a stressed healthcare system, some routine procedures or elective surgeries can be deferred without much harm. But more than half of the 2.3 million Medicare beneficiaries who die annually rely on hospice care, Medicare reported. To qualify for hospice, patients are deemed to be within 6 months of the death, which cannot be postponed. The New York Times recently reported that hospice facilities are facing staffing shortages. Because many put off enrolling, American patients spend only a median of 18 days in hospice. Even short waits can mean the loss of valuable care, from pain relief to help with household tasks. To make matters worse, this pandemic appears to have left us less prepared for future outbreaks. A New York Times analysis of public health offices across the U.S. noted several themes regarding this vital institution. Public health agencies have seen a staggering exodus of personnel, many exhausted and demoralized in part because of abuse and threats. And legislatures have approved more than 100 new laws, with hundreds more under consideration, that limit state and local health powers. And large segments of the public have also turned against public health agencies. Billions of dollars have been made available to public health by the federal government, but most of it has been geared towards quelling the virus rather than hiring permanent staff. Last and heartbreakingly, we're seeing a rise in the number of nurses, our front line in healthcare, who report more frequent suicidal thoughts than other workers. Mayo Clinic researchers conducted a national survey of 7,000 nurses and published their results in the American Journal of Nursing. More than 400 nurses reported thinking of suicide within the past year. That's 5.5% of the respondents, nearly 1% higher than the general workforce sample at 4.3%. Fortunately, there were no deaths by suicide reported in the study, but this reminds us all to take stock of where we are. So, Dr. Cowart, are we seeing delays in treatment and preventable testing like mammograms or lab tests?
I think there's a couple of issues here. You mentioned the staffing challenges at certain facilities. Nationwide, we're seeing challenges with nursing staffing, whether it be hospital, clinic, home health, and nursing home facilities. As you get down the pay grade, if you will, and down the certificate level, that care is crucial and vital, but it's not considered, quote, skilled, and it is therefore, usually the lowest reimbursed as far as a healthcare, worker, aide, tech, et cetera. So I, as the hospitalist physician, I may order a treatment, but if there's no, nurse or nurse's aide or technician to administer that treatment, then there can be delays. And so this is something that nationwide has been really exacerbated by the pandemic. I think our healthcare system was running at top speed and leanly staffed prior to this pandemic. And then over the past nearly 2 years, we've seen
burnout, the mental health challenges. We've seen physical illness. Of course, some of our healthcare staff succumb to COVID. We've seen staffing challenges that were pre-existing be exacerbated by this whole issue. So I'm saddened to hear that that patients may have challenges getting into hospice care in a timely fashion, but I'm not surprised. Healthcare is not immune to the staffing shortages and labor challenges that all sectors have been experiencing. In fact, Jacksonville this week in national news because of our difficulties getting our trash picked up in a timely fashion. So all sectors of the labor market really being impacted by these staffing challenges. So I do think it will get better. Hospital systems and clinics are now digging out from under the pandemic surge, and we're able to better turn our attention to everything else we need to do. And so we definitely don't want patients to delay calling for that preventative care. Even if your facility is taking a little bit longer to get things scheduled, or you have to wait a little bit longer, we are getting back to normal. And it's crucial that our patients not delay calling for those preventative services, those mammograms, those colonoscopies, all of those things remain really important for public health. Flu shot, it's flu shot season. You know, we don't want anybody putting that kind of really important care off because of the pandemic. Let the hospitals worry about their staffing issues and take care of things on their end. What I don't want is for patients not to call and get their appointment scheduled because they are worried about those delays. Go ahead and call, get it scheduled. We'll get you in because you need your care.
Dr. Reddy, as a listener, a social media call, Tom from the Beaches writes, can your panel comment on what the future may look like should, God forbid, another pandemic occurs? Will it be a free-for-all? I'm honestly worried that we're seeing a rewrite of all the good that public health has accomplished over the decades. So how would you respond to Tom there?
It's a good question, Tom. I think we're in an interesting precipice right now. And if we want to look at it from a 100-foot perspective as a society, right, because we have, what we saw was a healthcare system, as Dr. Parrott mentioned, that was running, full speed and lean, and in many cases was not prepared for something of this magnitude. Healthcare, public health, as you mentioned earlier, not just suffering right now, but has been sort of an institution that's been underfunded, underappreciated, undervalued for at least the last decade, if not longer. And what we're seeing also right now as a society, right? Huge kind of variances in what we should do from policy perspectives. I mean, we see states, I'm in Arizona, you're in Florida, we have some states, it's a very checkerboard experience. Some states that are taking very strong mitigation policies, whether it's around masking, vaccination requirements, et cetera, and some states that are, doing quite the opposite. And so, again, we're at this really important precipice where we're still, I think, figuring out as a society how we are addressing the current pandemic that we're in, how we're addressing sort of and figuring out what we actually think our duty towards each other is. As a citizen of this society, I think what we see is that, listen, it's checkerboard. It's mixed. From a healthcare delivery system, I know lots of major healthcare systems are thinking about how to better prepare themselves for the next pandemic, if and when this happens. And some are further along in that planning process than others. From these kind of population level policy perspectives, it's a little bit scary right now, right? Because again, depending on where you live, the larger sentiment around you, what this sort of over-politicization of this virus has become, I would say certain approaches, certain cities, certain counties, certain states are certainly much less prepared than others. And not because there's not good folks on the ground and not because there's not good public health folks on the ground that are trying to prepare, not only better address the pandemic at hand, but prepare us for the pandemics of the future, but because largely they are not being enabled to do so. And so I think unless we shift that, unless we change that quickly and I don't know that I see that movement nationally. I don't know if we're going to be in such a great position for the next time, if and when the next time something like this comes around.
Dr. Patel, are you noticing higher rates of burnout in frontline healthcare workers like nurses? And what are you telling your staff about things to combat burnout?
Yeah, definitely. You know, that's the thing. This isn't just, at this point, limited to any one discipline in healthcare. This is spanning all disciplines, you know, whether it's a bedside provider, whether it's somebody who practices in the outpatient setting, whether this is a member of our nutrition staff or our housekeeping staff, you know, every single one of them is showing up to work. They get out of bed each morning with the mindset of doing whatever it takes to get the job done under these extremely difficult circumstances that, you know, we've never experienced in our lives. And you know, we're fatiguing from this. And that's the challenge, is that it's not just the shortage of nurses and not just the shortage of doctors. It's the shortage of all of those services that are required to provide that care in the hospital setting and outside of it. You know, I am comforted by the fact that every healthcare worker that is able, that I know, continues to get out of bed every morning and doing what it takes to get the job done. That's what we signed up for, helping those who need it. But we can't rest on that notion and just assume that we're going to be able to sustain this. You know, what we saw in Northeast Florida this past summer, and all the hospitals across the region becoming extremely stretched, very thin, not just with personnel, but with resources, but just getting through it enough to where we didn't break. That's the big fear I have, is that in the face of another pandemic or something else, or even another surge, what are we going to do? And that's where mental health and well-being really comes into play. How are we supporting each other? How are we recognizing when somebody is at a point where they need help before they completely burn out? Those are the things that need to be paid attention to. And this isn't just within the hospital walls or within clinic walls. This is for the general public as well. You know, healthcare workers really have made tremendous sacrifices and putting themselves on the line, as well as their families that they go home to, and recognizing that we're all human. We get sick, we get tired, we have bad days, and just supporting us in any way you can, whether it's words of encouragement or otherwise, or frankly, you know, taking our advice and going out and doing what you need to do to keep yourself safe, because that's what we want for you. We want you to be safe. And if everybody owns their health, owns their responsibilities, we can get through this pandemic. And if we take those lessons and we carry forward, we're going to be able to prevent a future one. I think the key here is recognizing that we can be burnt out, and not just focused on what can we do to prevent it. It is that once somebody reaches that point, what are we doing to help them through that, so we can get them back to what they need in their own personal lives, and also to get them back into the healthcare provider pool, which we so desperately need. You know, one thing that we're not being very mindful of is the fact that we're getting into viral illness season, right? It's not just about COVID. It's about the flu. It's about the common cold. There's a lot of things that we need to be preparing ourselves for, and we need to make sure that we've got a repleted healthcare pool.
Let's kind of turn the page a little. And this show is airing on Halloween weekend, which means that the holiday season is now upon us. And other holidays like Thanksgiving, Christmas, Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, New Year's, not too far behind. Both Dr. Fauci and CDC Director Rochelle Walensky have given green lights to trick-or-treating this year, albeit with a couple of caveats, with Dr. Walensky recommending trick-or-treating outside, limiting crowds, and avoiding crowded Halloween parties. So this begs the question, what does this year's holiday season look like, and what should we all be doing or not be doing at this point? So Dr. Coward, are you partaking in trick-or-treating this year, and what kind of advice are you offering your patients that ask that question?
That's a great question. I think of it as, what is the risk of an activity and what is the risk tolerance of the person undergoing the activity? So for my family, I have two young to be vaccinated kids and two vaccinated parents. So we will probably participate in trick-or-treating outside, where we know this airborne virus is less likely to spread and get people sick. Can I guarantee zero chance? No, I probably can't, but
But I could say that it's a reasonably low risk activity. So we'll be outdoors. If we end up in a group of people, I may go ahead and put my mask on, even though I'm outside. I'm not this year so worried about having a candy slide or a trebuchet, or, you know, do we sanitize the outside of the candy bags that, you know, last year, I remember it was a lot more kind of frantic because I think there was still a lot more debate about the transmission of the virus around that point. This time we know it's airborne. Standard precautions should apply. Don't lick the outside of the candy bag, but I don't think that otherwise handing a piece of wrapped candy is high risk. So I think keeping it lower risk would be outdoor trick-or-treating. Consider a mask if you're going to be in a big crush of people, you know, even outdoors, can't get away from them. Somebody's coughing in your face, perhaps. Those indoor parties are where the risk is going to be higher. So if you do go to a party, an outdoor party where the weather permits, it's, you know, I'm here in Florida. The weather is usually nice this time of year. It's a great time to be outside. The mosquitoes are lowering. Yay. So an outdoor party might be nice. If all the available people there are vaccinated, that keeps the risk very low. The issue with parties is everybody wants to get inside and gather and mingle indoors, and suddenly you have a bunch of people inside without their masks on. So especially you mix a little alcohol in there, your risk tolerance goes down. So that's where I would be cautious, is having any kind of indoor gathering with people who are unvaccinated, either children or adults who are not yet vaccinated. It would be higher risk to have an indoor gathering. And so I would tend to apply all of these to the upcoming holidays as well. Again, by that point, we may be able to say that children 5 and up can be vaccinated, and that would lower your risk of any kind of gathering and holiday event. So it's all about keeping it as low a risk as you can, and knowing what your risk tolerance is, knowing whether there's someone in your party who's immunocompromised or might be high risk, even despite vaccination. The other thing I want to just add is that holidays are an important time to recharge. It's an important time to see family and to rebuild ourselves and our communities with everything that we've been through for the past 2 years. You know, we're still seeing that burnout and that drain on our mental health, even with the surge having left us. It's not 100% transactional. People are still feeling that fatigue, and we need to recharge. And so I would encourage people to think it's not black and white. You know, don't see your family and be safe, or see your family and be at risk. If it's really important to you to see your family, how can you make it as low a risk as possible? So outdoor gatherings preferred to indoor. If you're going to be indoors with family, everyone vaccinated that's eligible to be vaccinated, anybody who's really high risk for medical reasons, maybe that person should continue to wear a mask indoors even once everyone else is vaccinated. Other than that, I think we need to thoughtfully think about lowering the risk of COVID, but heightening our joy that we can get from these activities so we can start to rebuild ourselves and our communities and our families after what we've just been through.
Great insights and great wisdom. One final question real quick across the way. This is from our staff of producers and directors, and we all have this very important question on our mind as we finish today's panel. What type of Halloween candy is your preferred one? Dr. Cowart.
Pumpkin Malacreams.
Oh, wow. I didn't expect that. Dr. Reddy.
Snickers all the way.
And Dr. Patel.
Almond Joy.
Almond Joy. Okay. So we've got our trick-or-treating lineup, but well done. I want to thank our tremendous set of guests. That their insights and wisdom have been terrific. We have been talking to Dr. Jennifer Cowart. She is a hospice physician in Jacksonville and part of the group's Doctors Fighting COVID. Dr. Swapna Reddy, a professor of health policy, equity, and diversity at Arizona State University. And Dr. Chirag Patel, he is UF Health Jax's assistant chief medical officer. To the three of you, you have been fantastic panel to take all our questions today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure. And up next, we dive into the rising costs of prescription drugs. We'll be right back.
The human hand contains 3 major nerves, 2 major arteries, and 27 different bones. More of the body is devoted to controlling the hands than any other part of the body.
Welcome back. Chances are the last time you picked up your prescriptions, you may have gotten sick from the price that you paid for it, whether it was because of a higher copay or insurance deductible. Americans have the dubious distinction of paying more for drugs than people in other countries. And the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services project that net U.S. spending on prescription drugs will increase faster than any other major healthcare good or service over the next decade. Nor are generics immune. In fact, a 2016 report identified over 300 generics that increased over 100% in price from 2010 to 2015. Now imagine that you have a rare neurological condition like spinal muscular atrophy, and a gene therapy cure has been found for the disease, but the price for that cure is $2.1 million per patient. For most of us, that would put the cure out of reach if you don't have insurance. To that end, many patients are just fed up, and as such, medical societies, such as the American Academy of Neurology, are now stepping up to address this challenge. The society recently published a position statement in the journal Neurology on what individual doctors and the medical society should do and are doing to help. Joining us now to help us better understand this issue is Dr. Nick Johnson. He is Vice Chair of Research at Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond, Virginia. He is also the past Chair of Advocacy and spokesperson for the American Academy of Neurology. Dr. Johnson, it's a pleasure to have you on our program.
It's my pleasure as well. Thanks for having me.
Let's ask, I guess, at the beginning, why did a specialty society, why did the Academy of Neurology decide to address this issue?
Yeah, I think it's first of all, it's an important issue for every American, particularly those who need access to therapies. But in neurology, we're really at ground zero for the increasing price for drugs, because many of our, many of the advances that have been made in the past decade of the brain have really allowed us to create new, novel, exciting therapies in the past 20 years. Unfortunately, one of the things that myself, many others at the American Academy of Neurology noticed was that we weren't getting patients access to these new therapies. And so the Academy as a whole decided it was an important issue for us to take up on behalf of our patients.
So what exactly is, like in this example, is one medical society, what exactly is the group doing to help?
Well, the first thing we had to do was to really understand the issue. And I have to say, it is an incredibly complicated issue. Our drug distribution system in the United States is it's really crazy, with double arrow lines pointing back and forth, and it's makes it quite difficult to actually understand why are prices of drugs in the United States so much higher than other places like in Europe. And so the Academy commissioned a drug pricing task force, which I chaired, and the outcome of that was, in fact, the ethical position statement, which you saw, where we really started to capture what some of the elements were. Beyond that, the Academy has spent time on Capitol Hill lobbying on behalf of patients with neurological disease and our neurologist members for common sense solutions that will help to reduce the cost of medicines, and with a particular focus on the out-of-pocket costs or the financial toxicity that can be associated with some of the medicines that we prescribe. And those are probably two of the major things. Aside from educating our members on how to talk to patients about the high price of drugs and engaging with the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, again, to begin to start to understand, are there ways that we can have common sense solutions to curb the costs of these therapies?
So let me kind of if you had to sum up, is there an easy answer to say why are these drug prices so high, and would you say this is fair or unfair depending on the perspective?
I think there's not an easy answer, unfortunately. I wish there was. But I think, you know, every element of the drug distribution system is incentivized to increase the price of the therapy. So everybody from the pharmaceutical industry themselves to the kind of middlemen or the pharmacy benefit managers to even insurers, really across the system, there's incentives that etch up the price over time. And I think every single one of those really contributes to the increase in price. And I think all of them have a reason for why they're doing it. But at the end of the day, from my perspective as a physician treating patients with really complicated and devastating neurological disease, you know, I want to make sure that my patients, any patient I see, has access to these therapies, and many of which are pretty exciting and provide an opportunity to change the course of their disease. And I can't say that right now, and that's a problem. If you're thinking about solutions, you know, one way of thinking about it might be steps. And so one of the major issues in terms of understanding where the problem lies is the complete lack of transparency in the system. And on state level, states where they've engaged in reform or allowed for or required reporting of price increases and increased transparency for the overall system, you've actually seen in those states the cost of medicines not decrease, but increase more slowly over time. And so I think transparency is a major kind of foundational pillar of what needs to happen to get to really get at the root of the answer. There are other solutions, of course, that are more complicated and potentially more divisive, but things like allowing Medicare to negotiate for drug prices is absolutely something that has a lot of opportunity. And then I myself have been a big fan of creating an out-of-pocket cap. So these are things where you can cap the out-of-pocket costs for prescription drugs. We know 1 in 5 Americans doesn't take the medicines that they're prescribed because they can't afford them, and that's just not acceptable.
That is a huge percent. Let me, to that point, let me kind of ask like a social media question, and it's one that I get often as a physician myself. So Arlene from Flagler County kind of wrote, "My doctor typically gives me either a drug sample or coupon for some new migraine meds that I take. But when the sample runs out, I just can't afford the drug, and I have insurance. Should I not bother with the sample or coupon to begin with? Are those samples and coupons hurting, helping us here?"
Yeah, I think it turns out that over time, actually, coupons themselves are one of the perverse incentives that increase the overall price of medicines. But, you know, as a physician in that room, as a patient in that room, taking the samples and advantage of the coupons to at least get some initial support, I definitely understand and feel the pain of trying to deal with the patient in that situation. So I think from a system level, coupons definitely hurt. From a practical perspective, you know, what can we do as physicians to understand the cost of the medicines that we prescribe, have that conversation right up front, and make sure that we're getting patients onto the therapy that's sustainable over time, even if it's not the newest and fanciest version of a particular kind of medicine.
Dr. Johnson, I know I mentioned at the beginning intro to this piece the one example of that one rare condition. So let me focus a question on that. There is that drug called Zolgensma, a one-time dose of a gene therapy for a rare condition, spinal muscular atrophy, I believe in kids in this case. And it caught everyone's attention with its huge price tag of a few million dollars for the single dose. But the company successfully argued that the drug is cost effective. I guess my question is, are we looking at this issue the wrong way? Should we just be focusing on the price of the drug? Or do we have to pull out how we view this in order to understand a larger argument?
I think that's an excellent question. And certainly, you know, $2 million for a therapy gives you some sticker shock,
Yep.
But it is a complicated issue. The way to think about it is what's the value for that particular therapy? In some ways, one of the most difficult things about having a conversation about drug pricing is, are we able to separate out, some of the Me Too therapies? You know, this is the eighth version of a cholesterol lowering medicine, right? And is that really something new and interesting versus something that really does have breakthrough therapy? Other countries have been more successful than we are. For example, in the UK or Germany, there are governmental organizations that really look at that value, assess the value on quality of life and mortality for the patients that are being treated, and align the price with what that value proposition is. And if we could get to that place, which is really the correct conversation to be have, you know, what's the value of this therapy? Is it really making your life better?
That value is so important. In our last moment, any final take-home message you want to offer our listeners?
So for the listeners out there, I really encourage you to talk to your physicians if you're having trouble paying for the medicines that you're taking. Share your stories with Congress. I know a number of members of Congress are looking at different legislative prospects to lower the price of therapies, and keep paying attention to the way this is going.
Great advice. We've been talking to Dr. Nick Johnson, Vice Chair of Research at Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond, Virginia. He is also past advocacy chair for the American Academy of Neurology. Dr. Johnson, thanks so much for joining the program today.
Thanks for having me.
It's been great. Well, that's our program for today. If you missed anything, you can catch the rebroadcast tomorrow at 9 p.m. or listen to the full program at WJCT.org and on your favorite podcast app. Thanks to all of our guests and social media participants. Our senior producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres and Brady Corum are our directors. Our associate producer is Catherine Hobbs. Next week's program will focus on healthcare for veterans. Do you have a question or comment on this topic or suggestions for a future episode? If so, call us at 904-358-6362. Email us at health@wjct.org or tweet me at Jay Servin. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, and you're listening to What's Health Got to Do With It on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. Thank you for listening, and keep in touch.
This program is sponsored in part by the American Brain Foundation. For over 30 years, the foundation has worked with researchers to discover better treatments, prevention, and cures for brain diseases and disorders. Imagine life without brain disease. Learn more at AmericanBrainFoundation.org. Epilepsy Foundation Florida leads the fight to overcome the challenges of living with epilepsy and to accelerate therapies to stop seizures, find cures, and save lives. Visit epilepsy.com/Florida to find out how to get involved today.